ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, this is The Couch. I'm Jason DeRosso, and joining me every week, across the way there on the couch, the other side of my big pile of disused pizza boxes, is critic Wenli Ma. How are you, Wenli?
Hello. No, I've actually been getting out to go into other rooms at the Sydney Film Festival.
That's right. We've both been seeing a lot at the Sydney Film Festival, so we're a bit more kind of bleary-eyed than normal, but we are both back. We've managed to squeeze some couch time in. For those of you who are new to the couch, this is ABC Radio National's weekly critical heads-up on small screen entertainment. And well, this week we have been checking out two new shows. The first show has a wonderful theme. Should be the new theme of the couch. That's no, the Cape Fear theme.
Yeah, it reverberates through your body. I mean, I have to admit my first exposure to Cape Fear or a version of it was through The Simpsons. So the score for the Simpsons episode is very similar. They riff off that. And every time I see that, I think of Sideshow Bob with his like garden rakes.
It's the score by, iconic score by Bernard Herrmann, reworked by Jeff Russo in the new Apple TV 10-part series version of Cape Fear, starring Amy Adams as Anna, a Savannah lawyer who focuses on prisoner advocacy, actually, which is quite ironic. She's married to Tom, who's played by Patrick Wilson, who's a kind of big-name corporate lawyer. They're the couple who supposedly have everything, the perfect life, big house. Only, of course, they don't because the kids are quite mixed up.
Yeah, the kids have issues.
Kids have issues. And I think that's one of the strongest elements of this show, the depiction of that and the parenting around that. And this couple also have a dark secret, but their past catches up with them in the guise of ex-convict Max Cady, played by Javier Bardem, a man sentenced to 17 years prison for...
Sentenced to life.
Sentenced to life.
Sentenced
That's
to
right.
life, exonerated because of certain circumstances.
Yes. And but he'd allegedly killed
his wife.
His wife and unborn child.
Yeah.
So it's a particularly hideous crime. And now he's out because some new evidence has come to light. This is in the first episode. And we have this feeling from the get-go that this family are going to be under siege. And he is very hard to trace, but he is doing, you suspect, all these kinds of nasty things in the background, slowly ramping up the tension on this family. I mean, the first salvo I guess he fires, it comes up in the form of five dead skunks in the family pool.
Yeah, really unnerving. I mean, and also like a representation of what's to come for this American family who, again, yes, they seem perfect from the outside. I found it super interesting because in the 1991 movie, the Scorsese movie with Robert De Niro and Nick Nolte, and then going further back in the 62 version with Gregory Peck and Robert Mitchum, it's pretty clear that Max Cady did the original crime that he's accused of. And it's almost a fairly simple, like, here is this unstoppable, menacing figure, almost Terminator-esque, going after what is the symbolism of American family and virtue. And but instead here, at least in the 8 episodes that they've released so far for reviews out of 10, it's not clear whether or not Max Cady did the original crime. So that makes him a much more intriguing figure and almost and scary in a different way to what Robert De Niro kind of scarred the rest of us with. It is freaky. It's definitely freaky, freaky.
I'm a little on the fence about this new version and this, the waters that have been muddied around Cady, because I don't, in some ways, I don't think it's as fascinating because there's a bit of explanation here. There's a bit of contextualization. But I agree. The first episode in particular is particularly good and harnesses some of that inexplicable evil menace of both films and I guess the book. I haven't read the book, which came out in 57. It's called The Executioners. Let's give you more of a taste. This is part of the trailer of Cape Fear.
Let me ask you a question. What is your worst fear?
Max Cady was released from prison.
What does that have to do with us?
He's been locked up 17 years for a murder he didn't do.
You were his lawyer, right?
I had a good life once, too. Are you afraid of me?
Why would I be afraid of you?
You can almost hear the shots that are repeated a couple of times in the early episodes that are of the camera kind of spinning around a character as they're freaking out and kind of zooming in, and the world just becomes this mushy sort of blur, and it really evokes the anxiety and these moments of extreme heightened panic. But Javier Bardem, discuss.
He's very good in this. I think he's very good. I mean, the problem is you have... You know, your source material is a book and two movies that are 2 hours long. And then all of a sudden, you've got 10 hours you have to fill. So they do add a lot of extra characters. They add a lot of complexity. And a lot of that complexity does go into Max Cady. And I think not having it nailed down of his initial guilt does, as you say, muddy things up. But Javier Bardem, you know, he was so effective as the villain in No Country for Old Men. And I think you bring that kind of baggage when you're watching him. But it's a very different kind of wiliness to it. So they had this question of, like, he's maybe not a monster to start with, like De Niro was, but you guys... Well, he's been in prison and prison may have created this monster.
Yeah, see, I don't like that.
You don't like that?
That's that kind of psychoanalysis that kind of takes away from the mystery.
It's less visceral.
Yeah, that too. I mean, Javier Bardem is very good and he's laugh out loud funny for me at some
point. Yeah, I think it's meant to be, right? It's so arch. I mean, it does all the like distorted camera angles of the other films and of, you know, Hitchcock, because the first film was very much aping Alfred Hitchcock, especially with that Bernard Herrmann score. Mm. So it's still drawing on its pedigree, but I think they did make it a little bit archier and maybe unintentionally funny, but definitely funnier.
Look,
and freaky.
It's definitely a kind of Trump era show, though. And Nick Costa is the creator, and he's working with as executive producers Spielberg and Scorsese. But then they always say that, don't they? I mean, I'm sure they had some import, but to me, it's a very MAGA era kind of critique of liberal elites. That's what it is.
And like the smugness of it.
The smugness, and they're hypocrites. And if you want to understand MAGA, you've got to understand how people view people like this who are holier than thou, but they're actually, you know,
they're just as stuffed.
Hypocrites. Yeah.
They're just as stuffed up. And yeah, there are lots of peripheral characters who, some of them are served better than others. The kids get a lot more playtime because there's two of them, teenagers. One of them, Joe Anders, is Kate Winslet and Sam Mendes' son.
Yeah, and he's good.
That character
in particular, look, it really describes, I think, the horror of bringing up teenagers too. I mean, this is the new horror they've inserted into it, which I think is good. But look.
And it's what they exploit as well. It's what Max Cady exploits.
Yes. Yeah. Cape Fear is what we've been talking about. It is streaming on Apple TV. The first two episodes are up and new episodes drop every Friday with the 10th episode, which we haven't seen, the season finale dropping on July 31. So, Cape Fear, it's worth a look.
Definitely worth a look, especially if you like the earlier versions because you're coming at it with, you know, a sort of presumed knowledge. So it's a very interesting comparison point, I think. And I think it invites comparison because it's calling back so much to its previous iterations.
All right, to something completely different, a new sitcom called Not Suitable for Work, created by Mindy Kaling. What can you tell us about this?
It is a hangout sitcom. It is about five friends in New York City. They don't start off as friends and they're also neighbors in an apartment building. So it's very much already evoking, you know, Friends, the actual television show. But I think it evokes a lot of the shows from like the early 2000s and 2010s, your not How I Met Your Mother, Happy Endings, New Girl, that whole era. And I think that's very much a Mindy Kaling influence because she is someone who grew up in the 2000s. She was in her 20s in the 2000s.
Yeah.
And but these characters are set in 2026. They're in their mid-20s. You know, two people work in finance. One of them works for a celebrity stylist. Another one wants to be an actor and has just quit med school. And they're always like these recognizable careers that TV shows can go into and you already like, okay, I know what I expect from a finance sort of work environment.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. They're all wearing gilets and, you know, have way too much money. And like, it's enjoyable enough, but I also think it's so strange that this show about people in their 20s felt like it was made for people in their 40s.
Well, maybe it was because I looked up Mindy Kaling, and of course she's a kind of geriatric millennial. Mm. Actually, she's born in the last year of Gen X.
Yeah.
If you believe in that kind of stuff, in these sort of categories of as having any sort of specific meaning, I agree it's a little bit old fashioned. Let's play a clip.
Did a beautiful woman leave here this morning?
Yeah. Yeah, she was definitely in a hurry.
Well, that's it. I will be alone the rest of my life.
Davis, it's just one girl.
It's okay.
You'll be fine.
No, I won't be fine. You guys don't get it. I am the complete package. I am a straight man in New York City with a high-paying job and a great body, Cavs could use some work, who wants to wife up a woman and have four beautiful kids who go to private school. Do you know how rare that is? And yet, I am single. I am a loser.
You clearly don't think you're a loser. You just complimented yourself like five times.
I don't know. I found that pretty funny.
It is funny, but I'm in like my Friends. 40s. That's why I think. Yeah.
Look, I really warm to this. I like shows and even films, romantic comedies, especially about, you know, young people in the city and that intersection of kind of anxieties about career and anxieties about love. And Mindy Kaling's also pretty, you know, obviously she's pretty smart. And so I think there is something contemporary about this in the way that it does play with politically correct language and some characters are very cynical around that, the way they use woke language and woke speak in a way that wasn't intended to kind of get themselves in positions of advantage and so forth. So I think all of that sort of underneath the surface of this Friends-like, almost saccharine sitcom is pretty smart.
It is very smart and I think it's very witty. But I do think, like, if I think of other TV shows that are sort of in that vein that are current, things like I Love LA or Overcompensating and Adults, they're just a little bit looser. They feel like they're more the next generation after Broad City. And this feels like it's more of a, you know, network sitcom. And Mindy Kaling,
of course, throwback.
Yeah, that's where she came from. But, you know, her more recent shows like Never Have I Ever and Sex Lives of College Girls, which looked at high school and then university days. And she kind of talks about this as, you know, reflecting on her 20s in New York City when she first went there after university. This feels much slicker. And yes, they kind of do give room to talk about like that sort of wokeness thing, but at the same time, it's incredibly disengaged from the politics of the day. And
I was going to ask that. Do you think it even kind of walks away from some of the politics that it pretends to espouse and is actually
absolutely
quite a conservative show?
Yeah. Like, I mean, I'm not sure if it's conservative. I think it's trying to be apolitical, which is, of course, a political choice in 2026. And, you know, it doesn't engage at all with New York's, you know, kind of political awakening under Mamdani. It doesn't engage at all with Trump. It doesn't engage at all with wealth inequality or AI. I mean, it's a workplace comedy and no one is talking about the existential technological challenge coming down the track. And they're like at the start of their careers.
What about its take on diversity? Because, I mean, just, you know, through the casting, it's a very diverse show and it looks like how New York looks when you get off the plane.
I think that's great. And I think they do that without talking about it really, like it's presented as is. And I think that is something that TV writers, creators and filmmakers and stuff were almost aspiring to probably around 8 or 10 years ago, whereas they might have pointed to it and now it's just a thing. So I think that's really wonderful. And the fact they don't make a big point about it. But other than that, it feels like one of those shows that wants to, you know, be sharp and witty, but it doesn't want to poke you too much because it doesn't want to upset people.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And people might think I'm a bit of a hypocrite myself by saying, by sort of dumping on the Four Seasons last week for being a bit too much of a throwback. But I, this one just kind of
it vibes with
hits
you.
Right for me.
Oh, it vibed with me too. Like, I watched it in 2 days.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there you go. I think that's a qualified thumbs up from you and thumbs up from me. Not Suitable for Work is what it's called. It's screening on Disney Plus. Two new episodes dropping weekly until the end of June. And that is The Couch for another week. Thank you for listening. Hope to see you next week. I'm Jason DeRosso.
I'm Wenli Ma.
See ya.
Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.